And as we saw in Libya, the result of such a model is a country that becomes fragmented, loses its sovereign authority, faces a power vacuum, and is stripped of its capabilities, gaining nothing in return.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. First, Iran condemns draft resolution by US, E3 at IAEA BOG. Iran's permanent representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Reza Najafi, censured a draft resolution proposed by the United States and three European countries at the IAEA Board of Governors, calling it a bid to impose unjustified and illegal reporting obligations on the United Nations Atomic Agency's Director General Rafael Grossi. The anti-Iranian resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors will not change Iran's status of safeguards implementation, Najafi said ahead of the upcoming BOG meeting, which took place from November 19 to 21 in Vienna. He argued that Washington and the E3 are once again trying to manipulate international mechanisms in order to impose their unreasonable and coercive positions on the Iranian nation. Forcing Grossi to base reports on expired UN Security Council resolutions is not only completely unlawful and unjustified, but will also, in practice, increase existing complexities and deal another setback to diplomacy, the Iranian diplomat added. Iran warns of countermeasures against illegal IAEA resolution. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Tehran is considering more countermeasures against an illegal resolution adopted by the International Atomic Energy Agency regarding the country's peaceful nuclear program. Ismail Baghaei made the remarks on November 21, one day after the IAEA's 35-member Board of Governors passed the anti-Iran resolution put forward by France, the UK, Germany, and the United States. In response, Tehran announced the termination of the deal it signed in Egypt's Cairo in September to resume cooperation with the UN's nuclear watchdog. The ties had been suspended after the deadly US-Israel aggression against Iran in June. Baghaei said in an official letter to the agency, "We declared that the so-called Cairo agreement, which had been reached with Iran's goodwill and after relatively long negotiations with the agency, is now cancelled. Other measures are also under consideration." Tehran Times. MPs ponder response to IAEA's anti-Iran resolution. The National Security and Foreign Policy Committee of the Iranian Parliament categorically condemned the recently adopted anti-Iran resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency after beginning the process to devise an appropriate response. Ebrahim Rezaei, the spokesperson for the committee, dismissed the resolution as politically motivated and illegal, highlighting the need to show a strong and deterrent reaction to the move. He made the comments following an extraordinary session of the committee attended by Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and the Deputy Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Rezaei had previously suggested that Tehran leave the NPT. This session was held in order to review the IAEA's recent resolution against the Islamic Republic of Iran, he explained. IRNA. Russia anti-Iran resolution by IAEA BOG is a serious blow to credibility of agency. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said that Russia considers the anti-Iranian and provocative resolution of the International Atomic Energy Agency proposed by the Western camp a serious blow to international confidence in the IAEA safeguards and the nuclear NPT. Reacting to the vote of the IAEA Board of Governors on the draft resolution on the NPT safeguards agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Zakharova said that there is no need for emergency action by the IAEA Board of Governors regarding the verification activities in Iran. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson pointed out that the IAEA Secretariat had not requested any instructions from the IAEA Board of Governors. She said that Russia recognizes Iran's continued adherence its obligations under the NPT and the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, despite the U.S. and Israeli attacks on its nuclear facilities under IAEA safeguards in June. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative. For many years, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has been the target of political pressure and Western allegations. Before the JCPOA, the possible military dimensions file became the centerpiece of sanctions and threats. But when that file was formally closed in 2015, the pretext disappeared, albeit for a while. After the JCPOA was signed, Iran complied. The United States did not, walking away in 2018. Europe, meanwhile, never delivered the economic benefits it had promised. In response, Iran exercised its JCPOA-defined rights and scaled back commitments. 7 years of diplomacy followed. Iran says it approached negotiations in good faith. Western governments, however, responded with delays and ever-increasing demands.
When the Zionist regime carried out its illegal attack against Iran and its nuclear facilities, European countries not only refused to condemn it, they even expressed satisfaction. They particularly welcomed any adverse event that might occur in Iran, whether targeting nuclear sites or even affecting Iranian civilians. This clearly shows that the concerns the West claims to have about Iran are not technical at all. They are entirely political. There are numerous precedents for this. Consider the nuclear agreement. When the United States withdrew from the JCPOA, Europe, despite its explicit commitments under the deal, did not activate the snapback mechanism against the US, nor did it uphold its promised cooperation with Iran. In one of the joint meetings about a year after the US withdrawal in 2019, the Europeans made a series of commitments during the session with the JCPOA Joint Commission, yet they failed to fulfill any of them. They even pretended to introduce certain initiatives to preserve the agreement and deliver the economic benefits Iran was supposed to receive, but none of these materialized. In practice, Europe's conduct after the JCPOA and following the US withdrawal demonstrated that they were playing a complementary role to the United States. Europeans maintained a diplomatic facade of commitment, but in reality, they sought to ensure that only Iran remained bound to the agreement, while Iran received none of the benefits it was promised.
On November 20th, Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new resolution as illegal and unjustifiable, imposed under pressure from Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin. Hours later, Iran's foreign minister announced that the Cairo agreement between Iran and the IAEA can no longer be implemented. Tehran notes that 5 months earlier, a biased IAEA report helped clear the way for the June attacks carried out by Israel and the United States. Even then, Iran continued cooperating. Back in September, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi made a new inspection agreement in Cairo, only for the European Troika and the U.S. to revive snapback once again. Supported by Russia and China, Iran rejected the process as legally invalid. From Iran's perspective, the West's decision to activate the snapback killed the Cairo agreement outright. Now, Tehran says that the U.S. must answer one basic question. If U.S. President Donald Trump claims that he destroyed Iran's nuclear facilities, then what exactly does the West want to inspect? The new resolution seeks to revive demands from long-expired U.N. resolutions requiring Iran to suspend enrichment. According to Iran, the board has no legal authority to resurrect terminated Security Council measures. The Troika's attempt to imply such authority exposes bad faith and disregard for IAEA procedures. To Tehran, the text reads like a manifesto of threats aimed at restricting Iran's strategic capabilities, a project championed for decades by the U.S., Europe, and Israel.
Iran has several possible courses of action. The first is a snapback against snapback approach, meaning we raise the cost of such measures to a level that Europeans reconsider exerting pressure on the Islamic Republic. Part of this relates to energy, and part of it concerns international waterways such as Bab el-Mandeb, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. Iran has the ability to raise Europe's energy costs to a point where some governments, already facing economic crises, may regret entering a game designed for them by the Americans. In parts of Europe, there are still rational actors who do not wish to follow U.S. policy line by line. The second path is through diplomacy. We must continue dialogue and emphasize our right to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, a right recognized under international law and accepted by all. We're still within the framework of the NPT. We have not withdrawn, and we should maintain this course to reach a balance between pressures and resistance. The third option is reaching a point of no return, moving the nuclear program to the edge of breakout, enriching up to 90%, conducting a nuclear test, withdrawing from the NPT, and disrupting the regional order the United States seeks to impose. But entering such a path could lead to a conflict whose scope is unknown, including whether it could escalate into a global war.
Yet, Iran emphasizes a key point. Not one IAEA inspection report has ever accused Iran of blocking inspectors. Not one. Before the attacks, Iran had the highest inspection rate in the world. Nearly three-quarters of IAEA verification activities in all safeguard agreement states occurred in Iran. In 2024, the IAEA conducted 1,381 inspector days there. Among 32 countries operating without the additional protocol, Iran, with only 3% of global enrichment capacity, accounted for more than 70% of all inspections. But while Iran's transparency has been unmatched, Israel, armed with an undeclared nuclear arsenal estimated up to 400 warheads and never a member of the NPT, operates outside any inspections. UN Resolution 487 demanded that Israel place its facilities under safeguards. It never has. The result, from Iran's perspective, the IAEA is no longer acting as a neutral arbiter. What was meant to be an impartial watchdog now appears to function as a vehicle for Western political pressure.
In short, Israel has not accepted the NPT, whereas Iran has. Israel is a member of the IAEA, but it has never signed the agency's most fundamental treaty, and because it has not signed it, it does not consider itself bound by it. So why is there no pressure on Israel? Because it's an ally of the United States, Germany, the UK, France, and other dominant powers. In today's world, international law is not what truly governs. Power does. It is power that shapes international relations. That's why Israel, backed by the US, the UK, France, Germany, and others, can simply refuse to join the NPT, remain a member of the IAEA, and at the same time possess more than 300 nuclear warheads. Why cannot Iran do the same? First, because they would never accept it. Iran has fundamentally challenged international order and the existing balance of power. Iran views this system as hegemonic and domineering and is in confrontation with it on various fronts, including the nuclear issue. So it's clear that they will seize on any pretext, including the nuclear file, to prevent Iran from operating outside the NPT framework, even if those activities are purely peaceful. For them, this is a convenient instrument to maintain pressure on a country that has dared to challenge the existing international system.
After 22 years of allegations and political maneuvering, the IAEA Board of Governors' latest resolution confirms that the agency is no longer an independent supervisor. It is an operational arm of Western policy, applying pressure, issuing threats, and advancing a strategy of containment. Tehran views the resolution as the final, unmistakable sign of a system no longer aligned with fairness, impartiality, or the principles of the non-proliferation regime.
We asked Dr. Abedi to outline the possible scenarios that lie ahead.
What do you think would be Iran's next move?
It seems the United States and Europe are once again trying to pull Iran back to the negotiating table, but for an unfair agreement, one based on their imposed conditions. One of the key conditions they insisted on in the past and continue to insist on today, despite its illegality, is stripping Iran of its right to uranium enrichment. This, in fact, is the most optimistic scenario. I personally believe there is also a more pessimistic scenario, that the West is not actually seeking oversight of Iran's nuclear program. Rather, they want additional intelligence about the facilities that were attacked and about enriched materials buried beneath them, so they can complete the sabotage of operations previously carried out against Iran's nuclear program. Even in the optimistic scenario, their aim is to shut down Iran's nuclear program and reduce it to whatever level they consider acceptable. There is also a third scenario, neither a new agreement nor a military strike, but instead an escalation of maximum pressure on Iran. To intensify this pressure, they seek a legal mechanism. The Board of Governors resolution is essentially an attempt to give legal cover to the unjust pressure they want to impose. Iran is familiar with all these scenarios and has prepared itself accordingly. Over the past two decades, and even after the Zionist regime's recent attack, Iran's primary effort has consistently been to follow a legal and legitimate path, cooperate with international institutions, and rebuild international confidence in its nuclear program, not merely the confidence of Western governments. In my view, the most likely scenario is that Iran will once again pursue a legal process to disrupt and counter this Western strategy against it.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Today's tip, how management is manifested in worship and in ubudiyya, our servitude and our obedience to Allah. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how management is manifested in ubudiyya, in our worship, in our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So, you know, just like all of the various different aspects of our life, You know, management is manifested also in our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. You know, the whole universe, the earth, the, you know, solar system, all of these things are in a very beautiful harmony, and they are in a certain order. And that order is really what is called management. Now, when we come out of this very universal idea of management, you know, and we come down to the earth, we see that everything upon the earth, you know, plant life, animal life, the various different ecosystems across the world, they are all in this very beautiful, managed, ordered, and organized state. And this is one of the beauties of the natural world and the overall solar system and the galaxies and the universe and the cosmos, is that there's this very beautiful order and this beautiful management of all of these things. And it really, the more you think about it, you know, the more amazing all of it really seems. So if anybody, you know, if you have a pet at home, you will realize that cleaning up after a pet is incredibly tedious. I mean, you constantly have to feed the pet, you know, you have to constantly clean the pet, you have to constantly clean up after the pet. And when you look at the natural world, there's nobody, you know, cleaning up after all of these animals that are in the wild or the plant life, or nobody's actively feeding any of them. There's like, I don't know, millions of animals and millions of plants and millions of insects. But this beautiful management is very, you know, divinely manifested in the natural world. And then when we come to human beings, we see that the body is very beautifully managed. And so likewise, this management can also be very clearly seen in the social issues of humanity, the political issues of humanity, the economic issues of humanity. And so when we look at worship, when we look at ubudiyya, you know, and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah, of course, this management is also manifested in this ubudiyya.
IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
The reality of order is one of the greatest proofs of God's existence. There is such an order in everything in the universe, from a fly's wing to the stars in the skies, to an atom to the depths of the seas, that it reflects the Creator's existence like a sun. Yes, order can only emerge from a single hand. If many hands interfere in a task, then it becomes muddled. A country cannot have two kings, a province cannot have two governors, and a village cannot have two chiefs. If there are two heads, then there will be disorder, since this universe has order instead of chaos. God, who established this order, must be existent and unique. This exquisite order, which is in sight, cannot be explained by anything other than God's existence. The Holy Quran attracts the attention to this reality with the following verse: He who created the seven heavens, one above another, no want of proportion wilt thou see in the creation of God, most gracious. So turn thy vision again. Seest thou any flaw? Again turn thy vision a second time. Thy vision will come back to thee dull and discomfited, in a state worn out. Surah Al-Mulk, verses 3-4. Books with loads of volumes can be written and have been written to explain the universe's order. A book can be written even regarding the orderliness of a fly's body. We will only examine the smallest building block of material, the atom, and refer the balance found in the universe and its articles to science books. Everything from the air, water, mountains, animals, plants, and our bodies, to the sofa that you are sitting on. In summary, everything that you see, from the smallest to the largest, everything you touch and feel, is comprised of atoms. Atoms are so small that it is not possible to see these tiny particles even through the most powerful microscopes. Let us try to demonstrate the smallness of atoms through an example. Imagine having a key in your hand. Surely, it is impossible for you to see the atoms in this key. Let us assume that you maximized the key to the Earth's dimensions so that you could see these atoms. If the key was maximized to Earth's dimensions, only then could you see that every atom in that key was the size of a cherry. Every atom comprises a nucleus, and every nucleus has been formed from the electrons revolving in the orbits very far away. The radius of a nucleus is about 1/10,000th of an atom's radius. Let us look for the nucleus and the atoms that are the size of cherries when we bring the key to the Earth's dimensions. However, this search is futile, because even on this type of scale, we do not have the opportunity to observe a nucleus that is so small. We could see the nucleus only when the cherry that represents our atom would have to grow into a ball that is 200 meters tall. Despite this inconceivable dimension, our atom's nucleus would not amount to anything larger than a very small dust particle. Now, if you wish, let us picture the order of this tiny structure. Due to their electric charges, the electrons in the atom continuously spin around the nucleus. All electrons are negatively charged, whereas all protons are positively charged. The positive charge within the atom's nucleus pulls the electrons towards it, and for that reason, the electrons are unable to separate from around its surroundings. The number of protons in the center of an atom is equal to the number of electrons on the outside. Thus, the atom's electrical charge is balanced. However, the proton's volume and mass are more than those of an electron. If a comparison has to be made, it is like the difference in size between a human and a hazelnut. Nevertheless, their electric charges are the same. What would happen if their electric charges were not equal? In that case, every atom in the universe, due to the extra positive electricity, would possess a positive charge. As a result, every atom in the universe would push one another.
Welcome back, dear friends. So we are talking about how management is manifested in ubudiya, in our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So now when we start to look at worship, of course, the Almighty Allah has made certain kinds of worship wajib, obligatory. That means that we have to do this because perhaps this is the bare minimum, and that bare minimum has been made obligatory because perhaps if that bare minimum was not to be obligatory and wajib, then we would never engage even in that bare minimum. It's quite profound if you, you know, rewind, listen to it again, and think about it, that the reason that For example, the five daily prayers that are wajib and are obligatory are wajib and obligatory because they are the bare minimum of what an individual should do who wants to engage in ubudiyya, in the worship, in the servitude, and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. And if this bare minimum was not made obligatory by the Almighty Allah, then unfortunately, we human beings would not even engage in that bare minimum worship of the Almighty Allah. So even making these five daily prayers wajib and obligatory, in reality is a huge favor and a blessing to every single human being. So anyways, when we look at the management, of course, these five daily prayers, you have five. That's managed in a very specific way. You know, when you continue in and you look at the various different details of the prayer, you know, you stand for a certain time, you recite something while you're standing in qiyam, in ruku, in the genuflection, you know, you are there for a certain period of time. There's a certain dhikr or a certain recitation you make there. You know, then you have two sujood, right? You have two prostrations. Between the two prostrations, you pause. So when you look at the whole prayer, it is very beautifully managed and very beautifully organized, you know? And so even when you have congregational prayers, there is a specific person who leads the prayers. That person who leads the prayers has certain requirements. The people are all lined up, you know, in a certain fashion. They all bow down at the same time. They stand up at the same time. They go into prostration at the same time, right? And all of it is very beautifully managed, and it shows this very beautiful organization, this discipline, this like the solar system. It really is something very beautiful to observe. And even our other, you know, forms of worship and our other forms of ubudiyya, they also have a certain kind of manifestation of management, you know. Again, management is not something that is very dry or very boring or very, you know, type X behavior, personality. No, management is this beautiful order and organization that is manifested in all of the cosmos. And so it is very natural and very harmonious for it to also be manifested in our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Foresight. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Tunisia made the headlines on Wednesday after President Qais Saied summoned the European Union's ambassador to lodge an official protest against what he called the failure to respect diplomatic rules. A statement from the presidency provided no details on the alleged breach in protocol by the European Union envoy, but referred to the use of practices outside diplomatic customs, a reference to his recent meeting with Nordin Tabubi, the leader of the North African country's main trade union. On Monday, Giuseppe Peroni, while meeting with Tabubi, commended the role of the Tunisian General Labor Union, UGTT, whose response called for the country's enhanced cooperation with the European Union. However, the revelation sparked the criticism, with the Tunisian authorities calling it an interference in internal affairs. We believe that the president's invitation to the European Union ambassador and his request to respect diplomatic rules and international agreement reflects a commitment to national sovereignty, a principle that was violated in the past 10 years. These comes as Tunisia faces a long political crisis with the reduced role of parties and organizations that has also increased the state's sensitivity toward any external actions. Also, the UGTT was part of the 2050 National Dialogue Quarter and seen as an influential counterweight to Saied since he took the helm of power back in 2021. Which the opposition described as a coup. The UGTT's ability to take on a larger political and union role depends on its strength and influence. Since 2011, it has been a key player in both politics and labor issues and an active partner in every government. President Saied has stressed that national sovereignty is a red line. Any political decision is in the hands of the government, and that relation with Europeans must be based on mutual respect without pressure. Many observers say Tunisia is open to cooperation with the European Union, but remains firm in protecting its political independence. However, the latest row amid internal tensions and the challenges, the future of relations between Tunis and Brussels remain uncertain.
The European Union has been Tunisia's largest trading partner and PLA for decades. The two remains at odds over a number of issues, including migration and human rights since Saied came to power. The summoning of the European Union ambassador over the alleged interference in domestic affairs could sour the relation even further. Iskandar Nawar, Tunisia.
First came the media campaign, then the pressure from conservative politicians, threats against members and damage to their property. Now the Austrian state prepares terror charges against one of the most established anti-racist and anti-colonial organizations in the country, Daral Chanup. Among the accused is their current chairperson.
The situation was similar like the house raids against our association Daral Chanup in February. The house raids were supported by heavy force through the special unit Vega, and they came into my apartment and they confiscated laptops, telephones, documents from the association, and also private books, for example a book from the 1980s in German language from Rastan Kanafani.
Following the raids, the activist lost his job and is now facing several charges for his political support of Palestine and anti-colonial struggle in the global south.
The state prosecutor accused us of membership of a criminal organization, membership of terrorist organizations, and also the kind of we are people who force others to violent acts and terrorist acts.
The association had to close their premises due to the growing legal expenses. The activists face imprisonment of up to 10 years if charged. The Austrian government launched its crackdown on pro-Palestine protests and activists after October 7 in 2023. It imposed a ban on the first rally that was held after the state, but activists went ahead and held the rally, which resulted in the arrest of hundreds of them. Now, 2 years later, the court has announced its ruling on the legality of the ban.
The Constitutional Court has now ruled after 2 years that the ban on the demonstration was lawful. We will now appeal this decision to the European Court of Justice.
Legal experts say this harsh repression of the Palestine Solidarity Movement in the past 2 years increasingly undermines democratic rights throughout Europe.
Gerade auch das Strafrecht immer mehr zu
criminal law is increasingly becoming a system of thought crime. This means that people are being reported and convicted because they hold a particular political opinion that is deemed illegitimate by the authorities. And I consider this a very dangerous development.
The European Palestine Solidarity Movement has faced unprecedented repression and discrimination in the past 2 years. Germany and Hungary are among the most repressive states, but Austria is taking even one step further, equating opposition to the Gaza genocide with terrorism. Dieter Reinisch from Vienna.
Pro-justice demonstrators supporting Palestine Action's co-founder Huda Amouri taking the British government to court in the first ever judicial review of a proscribed group.
This is the culmination of a really concerted effort and a campaign over about 5 years to completely crush protest laws in this country, which means completely crush the fundamentals of democracy in this country.
Over 3 days, the High Court is examining whether the British Interior Ministry, known as the Home Office, followed lawful procedure when banning the group in July this year. Last month, the government tried but failed to block the case altogether.
I'm appalled at the fact that genocide, the crime of crimes, is being swept under the rug in favor of the British state's geopolitical and economic interests. And we're familiar with this. I mean, obviously, I'm coming from Germany, where we are the German government is the second largest weapons deliverer to Israel. And the British state also has, the British Empire has interests that they are looking to protect. They are threatened by Palestine Action and by nonviolent direct action.
The hearing follows nationwide civil disobedience. The outcome of this court battle will have consequences for thousands of campaigners like these arrested for holding up these signs. Before the ban, which was issued under terrorism legislation, Palestine Action had targeted the UK-based sites of Elbit Systems, Israel's largest weapons manufacturer. They also sprayed red paint into the engines of two military planes they accused of refueling aircraft involved in Israel's genocidal war on Gaza.
The prescription has come because of a lot of pressure from outside interests, the military-industrial complex, political lobbyists, military lobbyists, both internally to the UK and externally.
The activists who carried out those actions are held in remand. Six are now on an open-ended hunger strike.
It can't be denied that this is all part of the same fight, and it's all inextricably linked together. If the deprescription appeal is successful, then it will prove to everybody that this is not a terrorist organization. And there's no justification to keep people held in prison without trial on terrorist charges.
In a dramatic last-minute twist, the judge adjudicating the case was replaced with a three-judge panel, including one that voted in favor of the UK sales of the F-35 parts to Israel, fueling accusations of a stitch-up among campaigners. Beyond the legal arguments, the campaigners here say this case exposes something deeper, and that is the length to which the British government is prepared to go to protect the Israeli regime and its interests, even if that means stretching the law to silence those who challenge them. Saeed Pourreza, London.
As Israel's deadly onslaught in Gaza continues, any notion of a ceasefire exists in name only, according to Francesca Albanese. The UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories told a European Parliament hearing on Tuesday via video link that relatively few countries have stood up for Palestinians.
The rest have been bending backward and forward to comply with the diktat of the United States, including European countries and European Union.
Albanese is scathing about the US-driven plan for Gaza's future, especially the reconstruction proposals.
The reconstruction plan not only is wrong as it's planned, because it's planned without the Palestinians and while the bombing and the shooting and the starving are still ongoing, but also because Gaza is a crime scene.
Several lawmakers expressed anger that Palestinians are not being placed at the center of discussions about Gaza's future.
It's so striking, the current EU reaction to the 28-point plan regarding Ukraine, where the EU very clearly said there's no plan without the Ukrainians.
Once again, fresh calls were made for the EU to halt all trade with the Israeli regime. There have been any number of debates and events in the European Parliament relating to the plight of Palestinians, but they effectively come to nothing. This is because any potential sanctions don't even get as far as here, the EU Council, and that is because the European Commission knows they'll be blocked by certain member states. Analysts argue that the EU has now taken a back seat on foreign policy, with the United States firmly in control.
I mean, the whole situation with the European Union in the Middle East now, it's clear there is no vision in Europe, there is no policy, at least no coherent policy.
Some legislators support Albanese's call for dual EU-Israeli nationals to be investigated upon re-entering the bloc, a measure previously applied to suspected foreign fighters returning from Daesh-controlled areas.
Was immediately, this is a potential terrorist because he was fighting in the Middle East, and now it's completely silence. I mean, the right wing, although they always talk about security and how to watch the borders so that no terrorists come inside, now they receive with open hands.
Albanese told the committee that the EU should suspend all ties with Israel except those required to enforce international court rulings against Tel Aviv. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Larajani arrived in Pakistan on Monday.
His visit marks a significant step in the ongoing efforts by both countries to consolidate cooperation amid heightened regional tensions. Shortly after his arrival, Larajani met Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif, President Asif Ali Zardari, Deputy Prime Minister Ishaq Dar, and other high-ranking officials and think tank heads, engaging in wide-ranging discussions on bilateral ties and regional security. The discussions focused on expanding bilateral trade, with both sides reiterating their commitment to removing trade barriers, activating the barter trade mechanism, and expediting the Pakistan-Iran Free Trade Agreement. Larajani also praised Pakistan's support for Iran during the U.S.-Israeli aggression against the country earlier this year.
We discussed all key bilateral matters, especially how to expand our economic cooperation and strengthen trade. Pakistan is a true brotherly nation, and together we explored practical ways to deepen our security ties, enhance people-to-people contact, and coordinate our positions on major international issues.
Pakistani leadership underscored Islamabad's commitment to deepening political, economic, and security cooperation with Tehran.
We discussed all the regional, bilateral, and global issues. It was a wonderful meeting. I'm grateful to my brother Excellency for his visit and sparing time to meet with me. And we had very open discussion about all the issues which are currently being faced by the regional and the multilateral forums.
Observers say Larajani's visit signals a strategic recalibration in Iran's regional engagement after the June war with Israel. They say the visit also underscores Pakistan's rising relevance in Tehran's long-term vision, particularly in border security, regional trade, and balanced diplomacy in a volatile neighborhood.
We are proud of Iran's resistance. They have set a new example because they have shattered the myth of Israeli invincibility through the determination, through the will, and the fighting power of the Iranian nation. And we feel that Iran showed that imperialism, hegemony, Zionism, they say might is right, right is might. And they failed miserably in that.
Larajani is the second high-ranking Iranian official to visit Pakistan this month, after Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bakar Kalibaf.
The latest high-level meetings between the top officials of Iran and Pakistan show that the two neighbors are not only focused on boosting trade and economic partnerships, but also on developing coordinated mechanisms for regional peace and security. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. 19-year-old Zahra Abdul Karim Mohanna had a single priority during the two-year genocide raging on them in Gaza, that is to protect her brothers and save their lives at any cost. Having lost her father, she preferred pangs of hunger than risk her brothers going to seek aid where scores of young men were targeted, disappeared, and shot. They have resisted the occupation and always will, Zahra says, but asks why they need to do that when the rest of the world is free. Here is more of Zahra.
Despite the history, occupation, and Gaza's classification as the world's largest open-air prison by many who experienced its suffocating conditions, there was a semblance of a life. For young Palestinians like the one who shared her story with us, there was a rhythm to life, with the Israeli occupation simply the soundtrack. Building a future despite Gaza's situation was something that kept the next generation hopeful, studying, preparing, and working towards a day when there would be a different world. Israel's barbarity has replaced that with something utterly different. Life under genocide was a literal hellscape. The struggle to find something to eat outweighed by the psychological torture, in Zahra's case, of wondering if the occupation would martyr or take her brothers at any given moment. Activities once considered routine now took on an additional layer of jeopardy. Some of the sights witnessed are enough to change your very DNA, such as the tragedy playing out in real time. It's not just the obvious lack of regard for Palestinian lives. It's also the way in which Israel's genocide has changed even the landscape of Gaza. Orphans have been created, children forever scarred in an environment that is now completely alien, with all familiarity wiped from the face of the earth. Coming to terms with the new reality of Gaza has altered some things. There is no way the people, the ones who survived in any case, would not emerge unscathed. Though the one thing that has remained is the Palestinian steadfastness. It was terrifying how quickly Zahra's life, like the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, became centered on the search to satiate hungry bellies. With such scarcity, finding sustenance would consume Gazan lives. Every day, Zahra checks in on the condition of her immediate family, a literal headcount, and then begins the soul-sapping business of making it through another day.